Welcome to the View My Seats podcast. I'm your host, John Lord. Today's guest, Will Carroll, is a highly cited injury expert whose work has appeared on such publications as Sports Illustrated, Bleacher Report, and Hardball Times. Will, welcome to the View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate you having me on.
So you live in Indianapolis.
I do.
And as the NFL converges on your tiny little hamlet in the Midwest for the Combine, tell us where's the best place in your city to grab a beer and a burger.
Wow, we have so many. You know, Indianapolis is a really underrated food town. People come to, you know, whether it's the NFL Combine, which happens every year about this time, whether it's the Final Four, which we get every so often. We're on a rotation here. We get it this year. So, you know, that'll be coming up here in late March, early April. Indianapolis just does events very well. But I don't think we get the credit for it. People just kind of assume it's this sleepy little Midwest town. But it's actually set up in such a way that for events like this, for big conventions, it is absolutely perfect. Now, you said a beer and a burger. Let me start with the beer.
I was hoping you were going to start there.
Because I do write for a publication here in Indianapolis called Eat, Drink, Indy, where I write about beer. And you would be absolutely amazed. I know that craft beer is taking over around the country, so much so that Budweiser felt it had to take a shot at it in its Super Bowl ad. But here in Indianapolis, we have so many good breweries, and it feels like we have a new one every week. My column at Eat, Drink, Indy could just be, hey, this one opened. Hey, this one opened. And luckily, they're all really good. I actually went on a beer tour put together by a local chamber of commerce. And me and another guy from Eat, Drink, Indy, John Ketzenberger, were going through, a bunch of people from the media, disc jockeys, TV people, and we stopped at five breweries. And at the end, I looked at John and I go, did we have a bad beer? Did we have one we didn't like? And he's like, there are some I liked more than others, but there wasn't one where I go, ugh. And that's pretty amazing. If you're coming for the Combine, if you're coming for next month, the Final Four, you'll probably want to stay downtown. It's such a tight, walkable downtown. And let me start with a couple places. The first is Sun King. Sun King Brewing is our second biggest brewery in the state. They've actually bounced off the hard limit for how much they can produce, but they've become kind of the house beer of Indianapolis. Maybe they've lost some of their hipster cred. Maybe they've gotten a little bit too big for some people, and there's certainly lots of opportunities there. But Sun King, their Osiris, their Cream Ale, some of the amazing seasonal beers that they do, you really have to check it out. They do a great tour as well. And they're right downtown. They're just a little bit east of where the Combine is there at Lucas Oil Stadium. Another one you want to check out not far from there is Flat 12 Brewery. Flat 12 is the official brewery of our soccer team, the Indy 11, so they do a lot of beers with them, and that's really helped them grow over the last year. They do a lot of really great beers. They seem a little athletically focused, which you wouldn't expect for a beer. They work with a local running program called Blue Mile. They've done the Indy 11 beers. They've done one with the Indy 500 with Hinchcliffe's Hinchtown beer. Just a great local brewery. You can also check out Tow Yard, which is a newer brewery that has a lot of capacity, and they're starting to really ramp up their efforts. Too Deep is downtown. Or you can check out one of my favorite smaller breweries, which is Outlier, which is on Mass Avenue. Now, we are starting to get some of these big tap rooms. You know, before the Final Four starts, the national chain Yard House is going to open very close. And they're saying they're going to have a local presence. There's another one called The District, which is a little further north. There's one, I think, called The Tap House that's getting ready to open on Mass Avenue, which is kind of our cultural district. But the local beers are around Indiana. There are over 100 breweries right now, and there's some great ones. So those are just a few to check out, John.
And you've gone on about beer, which is perfect, and I wonder if Indy is similar to other parts of the country where beer lovers are bordering on obsession like wine snobs.
Yes.
Are you starting to get a little sense that the beer lovers are starting to rub people the wrong way, the way wine connoisseurs have rubbed beer people the wrong way before?
Certainly it can go that way, but the thing about beer is that, you know, the snobbery is one thing, but usually if you have a beer in your hand, you're having a pretty good day. You know, if you go out to an Indy 11 game where they have a great tailgating community, they're kind of a minor league soccer. They're the second level below the MLS. And they sold out every game. Imagine this, a brand new team that really wasn't that good on the field, but they sold out a 12,000 seat temporary stadium every single game. It was pretty amazing. But everybody would be there. And it didn't matter if you were drinking a flat 12. It didn't matter if you were drinking, a Sun King beer. It didn't matter if you were holding a Bud Light Lime. You know, you're just standing around talking with friends and meeting new people and having a good time at the game. So I think at least in Indianapolis, we haven't gotten too far over the edge. I think the rapid growth, just here in the county where I live, just south, we've had three breweries open in the last year, and there's one more scheduled for early 2015. So people have said to me, you know, what's the saturation point? We haven't hit it yet because, you know, there's still a whole lot of Bud Light Lime out there. And, hey, if that's your thing, have fun with your Bud Light Lime. But if you want a good local beer produced by somebody who lovingly handled it, one of my favorite breweries here in town is Oak and Barrel. They're very close to my house. It's kind of like my living room at times. And they've been going for 20 years. There's no snobbery there. There's another one who, actually a former brewer at Oak and Barrel, opened up his own place called Mashcraft. He only does 800 barrels in his first year of operation, but oh my God, they're so good. And talking to Andrew, who owns the place, he keeps saying he just wants to be a neighborhood place. He doesn't want to be the next Bud Light. He doesn't want to be the next Sun King. He just wants people who are driving home and think, you know what? I could use a beer. Let me go in and grab a growler. Let me go in and grab a beer with a couple friends after work. And I think that's really where the growth is going to be, that rather than, some beer snobbery where you have to have, this perfect beer, and you have to have it shipped in from San Diego or Maine or wherever. Just having a good local beer. It was a few years ago that Budweiser did their fresh beer is better. I agree with them. That was the greatest campaign for craft beer ever because, a fresh beer is the one that I watch being made over my shoulder.
And it was Budweiser making that campaign.
Yeah.
Your enthusiasm is making me downright thirsty. I'm talking with Will Carroll, the highly cited injury expert and Indianapolis native. All right, Will. So let's just say that I'm a general manager of a football team.
Yep.
Or an agent, a player, where am I going to go in downtown Indianapolis to make a deal? Is there a restaurant that is known for the place that these power brokers gather?
Absolutely. It's the iconic St. Elmo's. You talk about an old school yet really good steakhouse, it's St. Elmo's. They're absolutely world famous for their shrimp and shrimp cocktail. Craig Hughes and his people there do an amazing job. The shrimp cocktail, which I have to cite, I'm allergic to shrimp, so I've actually never had it. But the cocktail sauce I have had, and it is ridiculously hot. It's a horseradish hot. It's not like a spicy Mexican hot or a wasabi hot. But before the Big Ten championship game, they've taken up having a shrimp eating contest. And Joey Chestnut, the guy who wins the hot dog eating contest.
Sure, yes.
And this year he ate 9 pounds. I can't eat 9 pounds of anything. And this guy ate 9 pounds of fiery shrimp. Okay. But, it's white, the waiters come up in aprons. It's white tablecloth. It's big, thick steaks. It's, really, really old school. And I mean that in the best possible way. Everybody goes to St. Elmo's. You stand there in the bar waiting on a table. If you don't have a reservation already, it's way too late. People make them years in advance. You'll see, you can sit down at your table and see a head coach to your left, a team owner to the right. St. Elmo's is the iconic place where you have to go when you're in Indianapolis at least once, and a lot of people a whole lot more than once. But we also have a number of other steakhouses. If you go over to Prime 47, which used to be Moe's Steakhouse, recently switched names, but really it's about the same place. They do a great business. They're very famous. The year after Sean Payton won the Super Bowl, he came there and stole a bottle of wine. Well, he paid for it, but a bottle of wine had been reserved for Jerry Jones. He got it first, sent the bottle back with a signed gotcha note to Jerry when he ordered it. So that's good. We have a Shula's, which is a chain of really good steakhouses, and of course a Morton's, another of the chains of steakhouses. So if you want beef, Indianapolis is the place to be. But don't be fooled by, you know, the old school steakhouses. We also have a lot of really great and really innovative places. Actually, the James Beard Foundation awards, just at least the nominations, came out today, and there are two places with chefs that got nominated, and I'm really excited about that. Actually, there's going to be an Indianapolis day at the James Beard House, just super time. So I'll name the two there. If you have a chance to go over and check out Micah Frank's work at Black Market, which is on Mass Avenue. It's about a mile away, really quick cab ride over from Lucas Oil. Absolutely just phenomenal food. The lunches are underrated there. The other one that got nominated was Greg Hardesty at Recess. That's a little further north. Tougher seat, very small restaurant, but well worth it. I actually saw there were reservations available this weekend. So it's because it's a little farther, it's a little less known. One of the most cited restaurants here in Indianapolis is Bluebeard. Just absolutely phenomenal and innovative food. You wouldn't really expect unless you knew Indianapolis. Just a couple others. Our Bistro, which is Regina Mihalik's place. She has been a central piece of the Indianapolis food scene for years. She stepped away, but her people have kept things going there. They have a new menu every week focused on fresh, local, seasonal ingredients. So it's tough sometimes. You're like, oh, I love that dish I had last time. And you might have to wait a year or even more to get it back. But there's always going to be something worth having there. And my favorite place for lunch, they also have dinner, but love Rook for lunch. It's in the Fountain Square area. It's right next to a brewery, right across from a distillery. So very well located. Yes. And Rook is Asian street food. What they do there is just phenomenal. They're dumplings. I cannot tell you just how good these are. And again, that's just a tasting of some of the places that we have here in Indianapolis, and all of them go very well with a local beer.
Well, I'm also guessing that a place like St. Elmo's, a place that's steeped in such tradition, is also known for their discretion, because I'm sure they have overheard their fair share of behind closed doors agreements between some of these high-powered officials.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we get more of that. You'll see the agents. Yeah, a lot of people, unless you're in the industry, you don't know what these agents look like. You probably don't know what the general managers look like in many situations. It's the coaches. You notice the players just because they're all as big as a house. You walk by the linemen and you think you've passed a new building in downtown Indianapolis. And there are places, you know, if you want to see the players, that's fairly easy too, because they tend to stay very close to the hotels, and they tend to go to the smaller places. One of the things that's kind of famous, there's a Steak and Shake downtown, the burger joint that's actually headquartered here. Rex Ryan and the former head coach of the Jets, now with the Bills, is famous for being there at like 2 in the morning. And you'll see players go by. You'll see all sorts of people stop by and just say hi to Rex. And occasionally his brother Rob, who's with the New Orleans Saints, will be there. And there are places like that. I can remember a couple of years ago, there's a Capitol Grill, another steakhouse, below the Conrad Hotel, and there's a wine bar next to it. And I actually walked in looking for a restroom, and it was wall to wall, literally, with players. Now, there were probably only about 10 of them because they're so big, but the place looked like it was absolutely packed out just because some of them were staying there or their agents were staying upstairs. So, all you have to do is be downtown and you will see the players, you will see the agents, but the players are certainly the more recognizable ones.
It sounds like, and we're talking with Will Carroll, Indianapolis resident, it sounds like part of the appeal of Indianapolis as far as a host city for these large events like the NFL Combine and the Final Four is that it's really easy to travel around downtown Indianapolis. If you were to, say, get dropped off by Lucas Oil Stadium and you're staying somewhere downtown, you should have no trouble getting to any of these places. Is that right?
Absolutely not. One of the great things is it's just this walkable downtown. Beyond that, there's also these kind of habit trail, walkways where you can stay inside. For much of the city, you might have to, try to dig around a little bit getting from here to there. It is cold and it is snowing today as we're talking, but, we got really lucky a couple years ago with the Super Bowl. But it is such a very compact downtown. You can go from Lucas Oil Stadium, walk a block north to the convention center, all inside, and then take a walk down Georgia Street and end up at Bankers Life Fieldhouse where the Pacers play. And that's four blocks, and there's restaurants the entire way. Indianapolis's downtown is actually known as the Miles Square. Now, it's actually grown past that, but you know, you could go from North Street to South Street, East Street to West Street. It's literally a mile square. And it, even getting a little bit outside that, which you ought to do, Mass Ave especially, get up on Indiana Avenue, go over by IUPUI, it starts to spread out a little bit, but you're still literally, a 2-minute drive away. Everything on Mass Ave is an easy walk from Lucas Oil. It's not, I wouldn't recommend it in the cold, but you could do it. Parking's not the easiest thing to do in downtown, but it's not ridiculous either. Certainly the prices aren't going to be. So yeah, that's really one of the strong points. When the Super Bowl was here and they had the first Super Bowl Village, they basically walled off a small section of downtown. And it was funny because people didn't leave that section. There's certainly a number of things to do. St. Elmo's is directly across from, the convention center, places like, RAM. Also I should mention, one of the secrets, most people know this one by now, but St. Elmo's is almost impossible to get into. Go in, go to the bar, see the place, have a shrimp cocktail. But trying to get a table during one of the big events, really tough to do unless you've planned ahead. But next door, there's a place called Harry and Izzy's. And there's also Harry and Izzy's up on the north side. So if you're staying away from downtown, you can go there as well. And there's also a Harry and Izzy's at the airport. So get to the airport early and try this. Harry and Izzy's is basically St. Elmo's. It actually downtown uses the same kitchen, has essentially the same menu, same prices. So you're not going to get off lightly. But some people walk in and don't know. They think it's really two different restaurants. And I guess it is in one sense. But it's also a whole lot easier to go in.
What the people of Indianapolis, they're at this point probably used to hosting people from around the country for these events. How gracious are they as far as, opening themselves up to these, the Combine and the Final Four? Do you find the people of Indianapolis to be welcoming of outsiders?
Oh, absolutely. And you ask for a recommendation or your favorite beer or your good lunch place or where's a quick place to do it. Absolutely. We had so many volunteers during the Super Bowl. That really people learned the city a little bit more and got to know all the things that we have downtown. Certainly the city is spread out. I actually don't live in Indianapolis. I live just south of town, for a lot of reasons, but I can get downtown in 15 minutes. So I'm down there all the time. The great restaurants are down there. If I want to go to, I'll just name a couple more that I haven't here. If you want to go to Union 50, if you want to go to Cerulean, which is just a phenomenal local chain, they have one other restaurant north of Indianapolis. Downtown is the place to be, but really there's also starting to be a culture outside of downtown. So if you want to venture a little bit, but everybody knows the big restaurants. Everybody knows the St. Elmo's, the Black Markets, the R Bistros. Everybody's going to know the Sun Kings. But the great thing about Indianapolis is everybody also knows that place that's a little off the range. You'll hear somebody say that the best burger in town is at Working Man's Friend. You'll hear somebody tell you that their favorite beer is actually from a place like Upland or one of the other smaller breweries. And that's one of the things I think is great, is that we have so many of these events and the city is set up so well that the people really have become kind of ambassadors.
If we can kind of segue away from the indie food and beer scene for a minute here and talk a little bit about the upcoming Combine itself. You are an injury expert, and I was really interested to see on your Twitter timeline today that you mentioned something about how the NFL will be requiring all the players at the Combine to take the impact test for the first time. Do you feel that this is a sign that the NFL is taking concussion seriously, or is this just perhaps a cosmetic change to appeal to our common senses?
Let me take these as two separate things, John. And it's a good question. First, the impact testing. I have no idea why they're doing this. I'll be honest. I heard about this today, and I've made a couple calls, and I haven't been able to figure out whether this is something they've done in the past. It's something I've never heard of them doing. Normally, the teams do this. You want to have a baseline. Impact test is basically a couple questions and answers, reaction times, and it helps the doctors and the medical staff figure out whether or not your brain is functioning properly. It doesn't have any predictive value. People are saying, well, you pair this up with the Wunderlich test and you'll figure out whether somebody's has a cognitive deficit. That's not what it does. So I really have no idea what they're doing here. So I don't think this is some concerted effort to kind of paper over the problem. They've done some things really well, and they've done other things really poorly. They certainly took it very seriously when there was $1 billion on the table in the lawsuit a couple years ago. But now that it's settled, they don't have that sort of same impetus. They haven't done a whole lot in the way of advancing the research. They haven't put sensors in the helmet like they said they were going to do a couple years ago. Their optics on it. You know, one of the situations we saw in the Super Bowl was – or excuse me, in the AFC Championship game – was when – was it Amendola? It wasn't Amendola. It was Julian Edelman.
It was Julian Edelman.
Yeah. Edelman got smashed, was coming out. Nobody checked him for three plays. And then, you know, in the Super Bowl, it didn't look like he got checked. Turns out he was. He had been checked. But these sideline evaluations, even when they're done, they don't look like much. And really, they aren't much. The fact is, it's like, how do you feel, Julian? How many fingers am I holding up? Who's the president? Things like that. And those are valid tests. But when you see somebody come off the field, shake his head, and go back on, and it's a matter of a moment, it doesn't look good. Whether or not it's medically appropriate is a totally different discussion. It just doesn't look good. So the fact that I couldn't tell that a test had been done, that if there hadn't been somebody on the ground there saying, oh, no, he really was checked, I saw it myself, and that was Dr. David Chow, former physician for the Chargers, if I didn't trust him, I wouldn't have thought it happened. So the optics of it are still there, and it's still a very concerning problem, not just for the NFL, but for youth sports. And if the youth sports don't get this addressed, the moms are going to start getting a little more worried, and maybe little Johnny doesn't play football, and maybe little Johnny doesn't grow up to be the next Julian Edelman. So if we start taking away some of the supply of athletes, we're in no danger of that. I just saw the thing about Rivals is putting up recruiting pages for sixth graders. Oh, so, yeah. 5'2", 100.
Might be a little too young.
Except it's not. I mean, there's a demand for this kind of stuff.
I guess.
People are buying tickets to go watch the combine, which is very literally people running around in shorts. We jokingly refer to it as the underwear Olympics. It's very important for the NFL, but I'll be honest. I have no idea why people would want to watch it. Same thing a couple years ago when the Super Bowl was here in Indianapolis. It was the first time they allowed the general public to come to media day. And I was like, why in God's name would anybody want to come to me? I'm media, and I don't want to go to media day. Yeah, it's my job. I have to. Why in the world would he? And yet every year it gets bigger and bigger. They sell more tickets, and people are happy to go because they feel like they're insiders. The NFL sells a great experience. I'll absolutely give them that. So as you see the combine, as you see the draft, which this year is traveling, it'll be in Chicago, and I bet that's not going to be the last time that happens. The NFL is selling an experience, and so far the problems they have off the field have certainly not impacted what they're selling on the field.
I'm talking with Will Carroll, injury expert, and for the players that are participating in this combine over the weekend in Indianapolis, what sort of liability do they have? If they go out there and get injured during the 40-yard dash, what sort of protection do they have against injury at the combine? Is the NFL, do they protect these players? Who protects these players in case of injury at the combine?
Absolutely no one. They're on their own. We've never had a major injury at the combine that I'm aware of. We'll get, you know, strained hamstrings and the like, guys who are just pushing it a little too much. And honestly, the NFL does a really good job of this because, they try to make sure that the guys are warmed up. These guys have been prepping for this. They've been at Exos or St. Vincent's or one of the places like that to prep for the combine for weeks. beforehand. So they're usually in tip-top physical condition. And the first thing that players do is a full, and I mean a full physical. And oftentimes it's double and triple because the teams themselves want to see something more. A guy had a knee injury in the past, so they'll order an MRI. They do all that. And honestly, that's why it's in Indianapolis. We have the medical setup that can support 32 teams coming and ordering their own medical tests. More MRI machines in Indianapolis right now than anywhere in the world.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. A lot of them are on trucks. They bring around to the state. There's some from Illinois and Ohio, but yeah, there are literally more MRI machines in Indianapolis during the combine. I think it's per capita, the stat I saw. Sorry, I can't quote it, but there are literally more MRI machines in Indianapolis than anywhere else right now. But the players are on their own. Now, there have been times. There was actually a player last year. I want to say he was working out for either the Falcons or the Saints and tore an ACL during his workout. And I think he got drafted, but not by one of those teams. These guys are at risk, and just like in the NCAA, they're on their own dime. They have to use their own insurance, which surprises a ton of people. There are situations now like Todd Gurley, the highly touted running back from Georgia, tore his ACL. He does have catastrophic insurance through the university that'll pay him something. Looks like he'll get drafted and be fine, but there's a chance he's going to lose some money because of the injury, and he'll get some of that back through insurance. But medical insurance is covered by the player or the player's parents, which surprises a lot of people and is one of the many things the NCAA needs to do better.
We'll save that for a different podcast some other time, but switching gears to baseball, I know you write about baseball a lot as well. I read something interesting by you about how Clayton Kershaw, on some of your metrics, is showing up as a elevated injury risk this season. One of the things that we always marvel at with Clayton Kershaw is his relative durability. What is it exactly that leads you to believe that Clayton Kershaw could be due for an injury sometime soon?
Well, hopefully not. There's a difference between risk and certainty. I have no certainty, and I certainly have hope that Clayton Kershaw is going to be a Hall of Fame pitcher and he can do this for years. But if we take a look at two things, first, his injury history, and second, similar players, there are some red flags, and you have to worry about that. And you have to be able, if you're the Dodgers, you certainly have to be able to value that. And I'm sure they baked that in to the contract that they gave him last year. But if you're a fantasy player, if you're just a Dodger fan, you need to understand those risks. A lot of people forget, as great as his season was last year, it was short. He missed the first month of the season after tearing his teres major, which is actually a small muscle. People argue whether it's in the shoulder or the back. It's kind of in between. It's not the rotator cuff. One of the muscles of the rotator cuff is the teres minor, which is where the confusion lines up. There have really only been two teres major injuries that we know of in baseball. We probably had them before and somebody said shoulder or back. But they both happened last year. And they're both two really highly touted players. Clayton Kershaw, of course, maybe the best pitcher in the game. And the other was Jurickson Profar, who was widely touted as the number one prospect in the game. Now, both of them had it in the preseason, and both of them missed significant time. Kershaw came back after a month and had one of the greatest seasons for a pitcher ever. Jurickson Profar didn't come back. He had setback after setback after setback. He's had a good offseason, but he's going to have to fight for a position with the Texas Rangers. What if it had been opposite? What if Profar had come back after a month and established himself as the second baseman of the future for the Rangers, and Kershaw didn't? What if he had setback after setback and missed a year? That is entirely possible. It's plausible. So I worry about the fact that he's had some shoulder injuries, the fact that he's had just some minor injuries, and the fact that he's adding up essentially mileage on a very young arm. He broke into the majors very young and was good immediately. And when you're good and durable, you rack up innings. And we don't know. You know, a lot of people say there's only so many bullets in the gun. I don't believe that. But you know, if you're breaking down the arm and not recovering all the way, you certainly have to worry about it. On the historical side, obviously, you have to look. The easy comparison is Sandy Koufax. And Sandy Koufax, notably, his career ended far, far too early. Dr. Frank Job, who invented Tommy John surgery, said if he had thought of it a few years earlier, we'd be calling it Sandy Koufax surgery, and he would have come back and been the greatest pitcher of all time.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's one of the most amazing things I've ever Frank has passed on, but I feel so lucky to have interviewed him and told his story. It's what I really think more people need to know, because it absolutely changed baseball. One-third of pitchers – when we counted them up a couple of years ago, one-third of pitchers have had Tommy John surgery, which is crazy. And it's only going up, unfortunately. But you've got Sandy Koufax. You've got a guy like Pedro Martinez, who is recent enough that most people remember his career and that amazing peak, but then shoulder injuries. And there was a minor shoulder injury he had in 2001, came back, obviously, and was really, really good, but then had to have shoulder surgery and was good, not great. For the rest of his career, certainly a Hall of Famer, deservedly so. But the one that I found in research, and there were other ones, Don Gullett, a couple others, the one that really stood out as a great comp and a little bit of delicious writerly humor for a player wearing Dodger blue is Vida Blue. and Vida Blue's career and Kershaw's, at least up to the same age, if you take them age for age, year for year, amazingly similar. And Vida Blue had some injury history. Vida Blue pitched through it. Different era. He pitched more, but not significantly more. When you take a look at how his career went, he was out of the game far earlier than you would have expected. If you had signed him to a big contract at the same age that Kershaw was given his big contract, I don't think you would have been happy with the results. I certainly hope that Stan Conte and the Dodgers medical staff can keep Clayton Kershaw healthy throughout the length of his contract and beyond, so that Clayton Kershaw someday can join Pedro and Sandy in the Hall. But you know, you take a look at a guy like Vida Blue, who was headed that way and stopped because of injury. You certainly have to worry about it.
Last question for you here, Will Carroll. In your opinion, what do you think the Yankees can do to get out of Alex Rodriguez's contract here? You know, there's been some talk in New York about how, you know, he may report to camp and they may look at the medicals and it may, you know, come up that something's still wrong with his hips. Do you see that the Yankees will they be able to get out of A-Rod's contract somehow by claiming that he just cannot physically perform? How hard would that be for them to do that?
That's a great question, John. And I'm going to tie this back to football. The difference between baseball and football on a contractual basis is the guarantee. In football, they can cut a player, no big deal. You'll hear about cap hits. You'll hear about, you know, how do you bring a player back. But you'll also hear about holdouts every year, or guys who want a new contract. Darrell Reeves' contract situation. Or Jeremy Maclin was a player I was talking about earlier this year, or earlier today. And, you know, he's got a big contract coming. Dez Bryant is probably the big free agent. And you see these deals that these players sign, you know, like 7-year deal for $100 million. They're never going to get that. And that's why there's so much of the money that's up front, you know, a $20 million signing bonus. That's really all that's guaranteed. In baseball, when you sign a Clayton Kershaw, when you sign a Giancarlo Stanton, you're locked in. And when the Yankees signed that new contract – for Alex Rodriguez, they were locked in. And at the time, they were very happy with it. You know, it wasn't a big jump over what he had opted out of. The marketing deal that they did was unusual, but, you know, gave them some protection. It was essentially a way to do bonuses. And there's not a lot of bonuses in baseball. You can get bonuses for all-star games. You can get bonuses for, you know, pitching 200 innings. But you can't do a lot of things. You can't give them bonuses based on a lot of different things, which surprises a lot of people. A lot of people say, oh, these contracts are so big, they should get paid for what they do. Everything should be an incentive. They actually can't. Maybe you could change the rules if you believe that. But the great thing about guaranteed contracts is you don't see holdouts in baseball. You see free agency and guys who take a long time to sign, but or sign short-term deals. A lot of people thought James Shields was going to sign a one-year pillow deal, but he's very happy going home to San Diego and being part of what A.J. Preller is building down there. But you have to, in baseball, really understand what you're signing. With Alex Rodriguez, yeah, he's going to take his physical here in a couple days, and yeah, they could take a look at his hip. We know that they dropped Rodriguez dropped the suit against the Yankees team doctor. That's going to be a little awkward when he walks in for that physical. I hope they let one of the minor league doctors do it. But it would be such a problem. You know, Alex has done his written apology. He's going to be contrite. He's going to try to be a good team. And nobody's ever accused him of being a bad teammate. If you remember a couple of years ago when he came back from hip surgery, his teammates loved him. You know, he was playing around with him on the bench and making faces when he was making hits. None of his teammates ever speak out against him. They might say he's a jerk or that he's egotistical, but you know what? There's a lot of players in baseball like that. They don't say bad things about him. Being a jerk in baseball, and usually they'll use a more vulgar term, really isn't an insult. If you're a jerk, that's kind of expected, especially when you're making the kind of money. You can be a jerk as long as you're producing. It's when you're a distraction that you're a problem. When you start hearing somebody call you a distraction or a bad teammate, that's where things kind of go off the rails. And no one's ever accused Rodriguez of that, at least not that I can remember. So I don't think they'll open up the can of worms of that. Now, if he gets injured, if he has another problem with his hips, and he goes on the DL, there's some insurance there. So, you know, if he's on the DL for 90 days, the Yankees do get some salary relief. And I've said, and I'll say again, that if he goes on the DL with anything more than, you know, a minor strain, he's never coming off. That'll be the end. The Yankees will, you know, just say, thanks, A-Rod, you're hurt, you're done. Go home. You're going to get your money, we're going to get our money, everybody's happy. The thing that's going to be interesting is those milestones. He signed a marketing deal with the Yankees. They got to market, the same way they did with Jeter. There were so many Jeter's last game, Jeter's last season stuff, and the Yankees made money off that. Jeter did to some extent, I'm sure. But they said, you know, when you pass Willie Mays, when you hit your 700th home run, and especially the big one was when he passed Babe Ruth to become the Yankee leader, that's money. He gets money each time because they thought they could go out and make money off it. Now, has his mistakes devalued those? Yes, absolutely. There's not as many people that care about Alex Rodriguez hitting his 700th home run, assuming he gets there. So there's going to be some question about whether or not they can negotiate those down. But they signed the deal. I have a hard time believing an arbitrator is going to open up that can of worms that might be renegotiating contracts, something that baseball players just don't do. I did an interview with Scott Boras on my old radio show years ago at Baseball Prospectus, and one of the things he was proud of is that no one ever wanted to renegotiate one of his deals. He goes, you're signing this, you're reporting, you're going to do your best for this employer for the rest of the time you're there, and whether they treat you right or wrong, they're going to pay you, and that's what counts. And I think he's right, and I think that is one of the great things about baseball and one of the things that the NFL gets horribly, horribly wrong.
Lots of interesting stuff. Will Carroll, injury expert, thanks for telling us all about Indianapolis, and best of luck this weekend as you navigate the extra traffic.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.